Welcome to City Club of Eugene's January 19th program, Three Views on U.S. Recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's Capital. Anyone who has been to Jerusalem and seen the extraordinary history contained there, with the Dome of the Rock, main attraction point in the city, the Wailing Wall below, the Western Wall of the Temple below, and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, only a few blocks away, recognizes that this is an important city in the world. Jerusalem also stirs passions and emotions. The recent decision to move the embassy has caused widespread international condemnation and demonstrations in the Middle East. Our program today will present pros and cons of the decision and analyze the political implications in Israel, Palestine, and the United States. We will also hear what it was like to be in Israel, in Jerusalem, at the time of the announcement. This is the 17th program of our 2017-18 programming year. I'm Joel Curran, City Club President-elect and a coordinator of this program. The City Club brings together civic-minded people to make Eugene a better place to live, work, and play. We are a member-supported organization, and our members have direct influence on public policy. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including AARP of Oregon, Movasagi Plastic Surgery and Zeba Medical Spa, Evans Elder Brown and Subert Commercial Real Estate, and one of our Sapphire sponsors, Johnson Johnson Lucas and Middleton. The law offices of Johnson Johnson Lucas and Middleton's mission is to obtain justice for people who have been harmed because of someone else's wrongful conduct. More information at justicelawyers.com. And special thanks to PacInfo, Simplified Commuting LLC, and KLCC. Programs are broadcast on public radio station KLCC 89.7 at 6:30 on Mondays. Now I'd like to introduce the speakers. And we've put together what I believe is a dynamic panel of speakers, and I've had the pleasure of meeting with them and listening to them discuss these issues with each other. Shaul Cohen, the first speaker, is an associate professor in the Department of Geography, co-director of UO's Peace Study Program, and Global Ethics Fellow with the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs. He has focused his studies in Jerusalem and the West Bank, concentrating on politics of planning, territorial control, and he has earned his master's and PhD from University of Chicago and was a Truman Peace Fellow at Hebrew University of Jerusalem and a consultant on Jerusalem and the West Bank for the International Committee of the Red Cross. Ibrahim Hamid, a Palestinian, was born and raised in Bethlehem. Ib has always been passionate about the cuisine world, and in 1969 he moved to America to embark on a new way of life, pursue higher education in psychology and marketing at the U of O. Ib is an activist, chef, and owner of Cafe Soraya, and has helped create dialogue between Israelis, Palestinians, Jews, and Muslims, and in my opinion, one of the most respected men in Eugene. Deborah Green is the Greenberg Associate Professor of Hebrew Language and Literature in the Department of Religious Studies. She earned a master's and PhD from the University of Chicago after a BA from Brandeis University. Her interests lie in the history, literature, interpretation of the Hebrew Bible, and has spent a great deal of time in Jerusalem in pursuit of her studies, and was living in Jerusalem at the time of President Trump's recent announcement. She has talked with many people in Jerusalem about their reactions and concerns. And now I'll turn it over to the speaker. Shaul?
Thank you, Joel. I appreciate the invitation to join you here today and to share some thoughts with you. And I'm particularly delighted to be doing that along with my colleague, Debbie Green, and my brother, Ibrahim. we're capable of civil and rational discourse about all kinds of things, and I think we'll be able to do that very easily today, despite the fact that the subject is Jerusalem, which doesn't always lend itself to civility or rational discourse. And just to spare you the suspense, I'll begin by saying that I don't think that the administration's announcement that they're recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and our intent on moving the U.S. embassy there quickly is particularly rational, nor is it civil. I'll get to that in a little bit, but I've been asked to provide a little bit of background in relation to Jerusalem, which is a very well-known city, and some of its highlights are familiar perhaps to you, but the complex political history of Jerusalem is one that makes life intense and challenging for the people who live in that city, as well as for those who feel attached to it, whether they are near or far. So I'm going to back up a little bit. In giving you a timeline of Jerusalem, I'm skipping by all kinds of important things, and I'm condensing, and I have by now only 9 minutes left or less. I've been studying Jerusalem for much of my life and lived there for a long time, so I'm doing it a disservice. That said, let's begin with the fact that Jerusalem is indeed significant to three of the world's religions, sequentially to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and that it has had a cultural, spiritual, and political role in some of the major affairs and tides of what unfortunately gets called Western civilization. So backing up, King David, perhaps a biological relative of mine, established Jerusalem as a capital for the nation that I belong to 3,000 years ago. And his son Solomon built a temple there, and their intent was that the city would serve functionally and spiritually as the center place for the Jewish people. They did that for some time, but it was in a region that has a rough politics, and power comes and goes and flows, and they were displaced. They returned after some time. 2,000 years ago, Jerusalem added a very important dimension as the setting for significant events in the genesis of Christianity and the life of Jesus Christ and his death. Not long after that, the Jews were again displaced from Jerusalem and their temple destroyed in 70, the year 70 of what we call AD. And in the next century, as the Jews tried to reassert their influence in what they still felt was their capital and their spiritual home, they were roundly defeated by the Romans, who dispersed them and banned Jews from even living in the city. And that persisted for some time, but Jews are persistent, and we began to come back to Jerusalem. A next major phase for the city comes with the advent of Islam. And the Prophet Muhammad traveled from Mecca to Jerusalem in what we're counting as the year 610 for his night journey, and gave Jerusalem forever a sacred stamp in the hearts and in the souls of the Muslim world. From the time in that century that Muslims took control of Jerusalem, their authority in the city was only interrupted, violently interrupted, by the Crusades. But the Muslims ruled that city apart from that period until the arrival of the British and World War I, when they displaced the Ottoman Empire. So there's a lot going on with Jerusalem before we even get to the 20th century. When we do get to the 20th century, Jerusalem comes onto that global geopolitical stage, partly because of its importance to people of the Christian world of Europe, and to some extent, though a lesser extent, North America. Jerusalem was a prize, and Jerusalem was important. And it was important that it be ruled by powers that were judged to be appropriate, which for the West did not include the Ottoman Empire. The British sought and received from the League of Nations the authority to administer the area that is now disputed between Israelis and Palestinians. And Jerusalem is its own thing, but it also cannot be removed from the broader context of the Palestinian-Israeli dispute. But when the British were getting ready to leave, they went back to the international community for authorization. And in 1947, UN Resolution 181 said that there would be an Israeli state, a Jewish state, and a Palestinian state. But again, around this comfort issue of who should control Jerusalem, that resolution said not the Jews and not the Muslims, that Jerusalem should be a corpus separatum governed by an international body. Not surprisingly, that didn't appeal to the residents of the area, whether they were Jewish, Muslim, or even some of the Christians who were there at the time. That never came into effect, an international control panel for Jerusalem. Instead, as an outgrowth of the War of 1948, we end up with a divided territory, part of which is the State of Israel today, part of which was controlled and later annexed by Jordan, and Jerusalem became a divided city. At that time, the population of Jerusalem was about 150,000 people. Today, its population is somewhere around 850,000 people. That's considerable growth. Now, I want to pause for a moment in this narrative of the grand story of Jerusalem and its spiritual and political history and remind you that Jerusalem is actually a city. And I want you to think about how easy it is to do right by Eugene, and how easy it is to forge consensus here, and the kind of disputes that arise over growth boundaries and policies of one sort or another. Jerusalem is complicated, and it's gotten to be a much bigger city than it used to be. And it has people living in it who are wounded and divided. Out of those 850,000 or so people today, approximately 525,000 are Jewish, a little bit more than 300,000 are Muslim, and somewhere between 12 and 15,000 are Christian. Those religious descriptors don't capture the nationality question or the ethnicity question or the political question in its totality, but they tell us that in the one municipality, there are all kinds of complexities that occur at the social level, but also at the level of an urban fabric. Now, there's a whole lot more to say about all of that, but my time is short, so let me come back to this recent decision. Jerusalem has been the capital of the State of Israel since its inception in 1948. Nobody needed Donald Trump to tell Jerusalem, to tell Israel that Jerusalem was its capital. When a peace agreement was forged between Israel and the Palestinians and some of its Arab neighbors, they left the Jerusalem question out because it was a deal breaker. And they wanted to do what they could without having the Jerusalem question sink all the other issues. That, to me, seemed wise at the time. We're still not where we need to be in relation to the broader question, which is a two-state solution, if it's still possible, an Israeli state and a Palestinian state. I believe that both of those states can have a claim to a capital in Jerusalem. But the United States jumping to recognize what was already in fact, and it seems to rush its embassy to Jerusalem where ultimately it can and should be, but today doesn't need to be, compounds the question. It squanders whatever there was of U.S. credibility in the area as an honest broker. It tilts the negotiation. It antagonizes the Palestinians and the broader Arab and Muslim world. And sadly, I think, leaves both sides, the Israelis and the Palestinians, more isolated, even if some, certainly not all, but even if some in Israel welcome Donald Trump's embrace. The bottom line is that this doesn't advance the peace process. It doesn't advance the welfare of anybody who lives in Jerusalem. My perception is that it's a bit of political theater, and I'm puzzled by it because it only seems to shore up support in constituencies that were already in the camp that made this decision. I don't know that it can be undone. I hope that the damage can be contained. But at a much deeper level, this is indicative of the fact that U.S. foreign policy needs to engage with greater sophistication and sensitivity. It needs to recognize that what harms the Palestinians ultimately will harm Israel too, and that what harms Israel will certainly harm the Palestinians. And I think that this decision is a harmful one. I'll be happy after the other speakers to answer questions. I know it's a complicated topic, and I'm grateful that you're willing to jump into it with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Joel, for inviting me, and good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ibrahim Hamida, and I was born in Bethlehem, as Joel said, so Jerusalem was a next-door city to me. It's where Mom took us to the doctor when we got sick, because that's where Dr. Saliba was, okay? It is where we went to pray in the third holy shrine to Muslims on a Friday, as it is today. It was where we went to get the best kenafa, that's a dessert, okay, in the West Bank, okay? So Jerusalem to me is not the history of Jerusalem, but it is my stomping grounds, okay? It's where some of my family lived. It's where I went shopping when we got the Eid, the holiday, you know, when we wanted to splurge, we went to Jerusalem. So Jerusalem has a different meaning to me because for the first 17 years of my life, I was just 4 miles away from Jerusalem. Okay. The complexities of Jerusalem, as Shaul and others that you may have read for, are enormous. After all, when three major prophets, Abrahamic religions, descend on Jerusalem, you could see all the shit will hit the fan, excuse my French, right? Because people are going to become visceral about it, they're going to become dogmatic about it, they're going to go into this possession, I possess Jerusalem, I possess it before you did, before even your prophet came here, and we will have nothing but problems if we follow that thinking. And God knows we do follow that thinking, because there hasn't been peace in Jerusalem for a long time. I was 17 years old when the Six-Day War happened, and before that, Jerusalem was in Jordan, and I had access to it. Now, when I go visit my family, and we want to go pray on a Friday in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest shrine to Muslims on earth, they're unable to. I can, though I live in Eugene, Oregon, because I have the almighty American passport. So it allows me to go to Jerusalem. My brothers are not allowed. Now they're over 55, they're allowed. And they, if they get a permission to go to Jerusalem, they have to apply for a permission. And their permission specifies that they're allowed to be there for certain hours. They can pray, maybe spend another hour loitering or finding transportation, and then they had to get the heck out of Dodge, out of Jerusalem, right? This is status quo for Palestinians, not just from the town of Bethlehem, but from all across the West Bank. They're not allowed in Jerusalem. Even Jerusalem, people that live in Jerusalem have been expelled, and the program for Judaizing Jerusalem is in full swing. So there are government proposals that are on the table to annex, for instance, a settlement of 150,000 people that's next to Jerusalem, Maal Adimim, to change the population, the demographics in Jerusalem, because there is a Israeli policy where it says 70% of the Jewish, the population of Jerusalem should be Jewish, 30% should be non-Jewish. That formula is not working out very well for them right now. There is about 40% of non-Jewish population. They want to do something about that. So they continuously demolish houses. There were 14,000 Palestinians that were not allowed to live. They were disenfranchised from Jerusalem when after the Six-Day War. There are some 200,000 homes that have been demolished for one reason, quote, reason or another, in and around Jerusalem. There is a little town called Walaja that is very close to Jerusalem that when the city mayors and other authorities wanted to expand the jurisdictions of Jerusalem, they wanted to include Walaja in it. But Walaja has Palestinian population, and that threw a monkey wrench in their business. So therefore, they decided to declare Walaja as a national park. So the, as Shaul mentioned, and I think that's very important, that though the emphasis is on Jerusalem, Jerusalem cannot be taken out of context, out of the greater context of the Arab-Israeli issue. There is occupation. Folks that live in Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Nablus, Hebron, they live under military law. This form of government, I think, should have been gone with the dinosaurs. But nonetheless, it exists. So it affects every aspect of a Palestinian life, from education, assembly, voting, from religion, whether you can go to the holy places to worship or not, etc., etc., etc. So it affects every aspect of a Palestinian life. Now, whether some people prefer to call it return of the Jews to their ancestral land, or the Palestinians call it occupation, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it may be a duck, right? So to the Palestinians, the proof is in the pudding, and the pudding is not very tasty. They suffer every single day. They're from their economic unemployment of 20%+ to all their human rights. My proposition is that if the population is given human rights on equal basis, regardless of the label, the ethnic label that they wear, I think we may have the beginning of a possible solution. But when we claim God, and trust me, those three religions are not bashful about using that label, right? When somebody sticks a Torah in front of you, it says, look, this is land that God gave us through the loin of Isaac, not Ishmael. And it does not say anywhere that we should negotiate it or give it away, so get lost. You know what? That's a conversation killer. Yeah. So I believe that the basis of peace in the Middle East has to be human rights. Not Jewish right, not Palestinian rights, not Muslim rights, not Christian rights, but human rights. Because before those labels are stuck on somebody, they have one label in common. And that's where we find our commonality, is in our humanity. Thank you.
Well, I should probably sit down now because these two gentlemen you just heard from are experts. My field is ancient religion. I do mostly ancient Judaism. I do interpretation of the Bible. I do some work in very early Christianity, when essentially it's still Judaism. And I do comparative work among Judaism, Christianity, and Islam in very particular subjects. And I do a lot of this work in the States, but I do a lot of work in Jerusalem. So the only reason that I'm here today is because I work in Jerusalem a lot, and I happen to be there every time something happens. But something happens often. This time, President Trump happened. So I just want to take a couple minutes in introducing this subject to say that some of the things I'm going to share with you may be surprising, because these are people that you don't usually hear about in the news. So most Israelis right now are, whether they be left or right or center or whatever, most Israelis that I talk to throughout Israel after this announcement were not very focused on it. As my colleague Shaul mentioned, Israelis know that their capital is in Jerusalem. It's where their parliamentary building is. It's where all of the infrastructure for the government is. It's in West Jerusalem. It's by the Givat Ram campus of Hebrew University, which is in the far west of Jerusalem. And Israelis are not really focused on Trump and his announcing to them that he knows where their capital is. They are very focused on getting rid of Netanyahu. They are very focused, whether they're in Likud, which is Netanyahu's own party, whether they are staunchly right, whatever, whether they're left. I mean, the left has been trying to get rid of him for years, but now there really is a focus. There were demonstrations against Netanyahu regularly when I was in Jerusalem. There were demonstrations regularly in Tel Aviv that drew thousands of people to them. That is what Israelis are focused on. This is like, for those of you who may remember, this is kind of like Watergate, even though Watergate didn't have the demonstrations, right? It takes up the press. It takes up the most amount in the press. And I wouldn't be surprised if Trump's announcement had something to do to try and get people to not focus on trying to get rid of Netanyahu. But I don't know. Like Shaul, I'm completely perplexed. The second issue that's kind of interesting about this that I will add in there is that the business about the embassy, you know, for many, many years, since Reagan, or the end of Reagan's term in office, I think, United States had set aside land, you know, one of these deals where they would pay like $1 a year or whatever for this land that was in the south, the west south, in this sort of Talpiot area, which is a very exclusive area in West Jerusalem. They had set aside this land in order to build an embassy and then never built it. And lots of very high class apartment buildings were built there in anticipation of this embassy. And recently, it's become very clear that those apartment buildings are going to take over that entire area. Why? Because, as you saw with the embassies in other countries, since the variety of terrorist attacks in the 90s, the embassies have become very, very large, and the land surrounding them is kind of like a no man's land. So when you go to Amman, you know, you see this huge structure with literally nothing around it. The embassy that Trump just refused to visit, right, in outside of London is another example of that. So this embassy would never have fit in this area now. So that land has been given over to these very nice apartment buildings. So if we're going to build an embassy in Jerusalem, I'm not exactly sure where that's going to be at this point. So it's another reason why Israelis were kind of like, okay, yeah, whatever. Like, they're not really focused on that. Now, the people who are really focused on it, interestingly enough, are, and I use this term, and I don't think in the United States we always get it, are the more evangelical Christians who, by and large, are from the United States. And they are one of those populations that Joel referred to in Jerusalem and in Israel, and they're really excited about this. And they put up posters everywhere after Trump's announcement, all over Jerusalem, that said things like, God loves Trump. From Jerusalem, D.C., in parentheses, David's capital, to Washington, D.C. Now, it only took a matter of time for people to go around and start tearing those posters down, but I mean, they were big, and they were on big lampposts, and when you got outside of the old city, not on the east side of Jerusalem at the Damascus Gate, but on the west side at Jaffa Gate or Jaffa Gate, you know, they were like on every single lamppost, and then people started tearing them down, but they were across the city, and there were other posters like that. And that's an evangelical group, and they're very excited about it. The other people that seem to be very happy about this announcement were, by and large, American Jews who we might term them modern Orthodox in our society. They identify strongly as Jewish. They are retirees, by and large, who spend some or a lot of time in Jerusalem. And they were very excited. They watch Fox News. They like Trump. They dislike Obama intensely over his agreement with Iran. They see Iran as a huge threat to Israel. And they have sort of believed a lot of the things that come out of our right-wing political machine, and they were very happy about this. They feel like it's about time an American president, you know, spoke the truth and planned an embassy. And no, I do not regularly ask those people, where do you think that embassy is going to be? I just listen. In terms of the Palestinian reaction, you know, I think that you can hear in Ibrahim's voice a very calm response to that. And my biggest question when I talk to Palestinians, you know, first of all, people who own shops, who own companies, who, you know, are in sales, they don't want to see an intifada as a result of this announcement. They know that as soon as an announcement like this happens and the Palestinians respond in some way negatively, it will affect their economy significantly. It will affect Israel's economy. But in the particularly in Palestine, in the West Bank, you have a lot of businesses that really depend on a tourist economy or an open trade economy. And as soon as the borders get any tighter, as you heard my friend Ibrahim talk about how tight Israel controls that border, that it's almost, you know, how do we feel about it today? That you're messing with people's lives and you're messing significantly with an economy that desperately needs the world's help to sort of get ahead and stay ahead. So you hear from Palestinians sort of a fear of what this announcement means in terms of just unrest. And on the other side, you hear desperation. You know, and I think that's understandable and it's fair. It's pretty heartbreaking because as somebody who's been there during the first intifada, was there during the rise of the second intifada, you know, my question is, how much more insult, how much more humiliation, how much more degradation can a people take until they break again? And you know, that's a sad thing to watch. And so I guess in conclusion, you can ask me more details about things that people said. I've kind of given you an overview. I haven't given you sort of specifics of sort of where the Bethlehemites, you know, both the Christians and the Muslims in Bethlehem during Christmas, how they reacted, how I believe they will react to Pence's upcoming visit. But I think that you can see that that the situation, like anything else, is very fraught. And I guess the one message I would have for our administration is that words matter. Thank you.
Okay, before we break, we're going to have a first questioner. Jack Dresser, who is a City Club member, will ask the first question. Jack is a retired psychologist, having spent a good part of his career at Oregon Research Institute, and he is vice chair of the Veterans for Peace Working Group on Palestine and the Middle East, and co-director of the Al-Nakba Awareness Project, which also promotes peace in the Middle East. Jack, if you'll go to that microphone, please.
All right, well, I'm going to approach it from the position of the Veterans for Peace. You know, every day when we pull out of the driveway, we have to trust our fellow citizens to follow the same laws that we do. So law is the great equalizer. And the United Nations was established to make this also true of nations. We in Veterans for Peace know the horrors inflicted by imperial war machines, and also know that a nonviolent path to peace cannot bypass justice. Only when dominant states commit without equivocation to the international rule of law will we achieve worldwide peace, cooperation, and safety that produces that protects the weak from the strong, when all can then collaborate, irrespective of size, rank, or power, to achieve our common welfare and survival. So my question is about law, and it requires review of some essential facts not addressed by the panel so far. The only quasi-legal basis Israel has ever been able to claim for its seizures and continuing occupation of Palestinian land and properties is UN Resolution 181, as mentioned by Dr. Cohen, the so-called Partition Resolution. I say quasi-legal, since 181 violated the Palestinians' indigenous right of self-determination under Article 55 of the UN Charter, and was never ratified by the Security Council, which was at the time drafting a plan for UN trusteeship when this was preempted by an ethnic cleansing blitzkrieg launched by three Zionist militias in March of 1948. This ended with Israeli control of 78% of Palestine, including West Jerusalem, which incidentally was not included in Resolution 181 for the Jewish section. But 181 was more than a partition resolution, as Dr. Cohen indicated. It also provided to establish Jerusalem as a corpus separatum, sacred to all three Abrahamic religions under UN administration. The following year, Israel agreed to this UN administration, at least for Jerusalem's holy sites, as a condition of its admission to the United Nations, a pledge it has never honored. In the 1967 war, East Jerusalem was occupied by Israel and subsequently annexed by its 1980 Jerusalem Law. The UN Security Council immediately responded with Resolution 478, declaring this null and void, illegal under international law that prohibits acquisition of land by force. The Fourth Geneva Convention, to which Israel is a signatory, denies an occupying power sovereignty over the land occupied, prohibits transfer of its own population onto occupied land, and prohibits confiscation of properties within occupied territory unjustifiable by military necessity. The West Bank and Gaza are defined by the United Nations as a, quote, belligerent occupation. As for mediation and dialogue, I worked in the civil rights movement in Louisiana in the 1960s. And know that consent of the oppressor within a relationship of asymmetric power is never voluntarily extended through polite dialogue, but only yields to moral, political, and legal counterforce, which is what finally ended segregation. And I agree with
Mr. Dresser, are we getting to the question soon?
Yeah. I'm almost finished, yes. I'm only about 3 minutes. Okay. Trump's declaration has ripped off the mask of American impartiality and released the Palestinians to fire dishonest American mediators who do not and have never supported their rights. So what should Palestinians do? Since Palestine now has national status within the UN system, would you advise the PA to take this issue before the International Court of Justice in the form of a lawsuit? Why or why not?
Okay. And who are you addressing that to? Anyone?
Yeah,
okay.
Everybody.
Who wishes to answer that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Can you hear me? Okay. Yeah. I'm not sure I'm really qualified to answer that because I'm not an expert in the legalities of that. I will answer it as a layman, as a Palestinian that lives there and has lived there and has family that lives there. I think in many ways the Palestinians that live there, including my family, had at least two stark reactions, one to the announcement of Trump recognizing Jerusalem as the eternal capital of Israel. Maybe he didn't say eternal, and wanting to move the embassy there. One is, as Jack has just mentioned, it unmasked the United States being a dishonest broker. So it never was an honest broker. Another one is it dashed Palestinian hopes. They feel like, all right, we are, instead of moving forward, we are moving backward. It insulted all the Islamic and the Christian world in the sense that it was a slap in their face. It disrespected them. There are 1.6 billion Muslims around the world, and I don't know if there was behind-the-scene consultations, and he spoke to all the leaders of Indonesia and Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, et cetera, and told them this was coming and sort of softened the blow or not. But nonetheless, to the Muslim populace, it's a slap in the face. So that coupled with him appointing, Jared Kushner, Friedman as an ambassador, following the advice of Greenblatt, his lawyer, those all speak of tilting clearly to the Israeli side, something the Palestinians have always alleged. Now there is no alleging needed. It is clear as daylight. So in a sense, the Palestinians took heart in that. See, we've been telling you the U.S. is not an honest broker. Now it is not just our saying that. He said it himself. So whether to take it to the Court of Justice, we know that the U.N. as well as the Court of Justice is always subject to the powers of the world. And that, to me, is another example of what happened with the Trump thing, is it reaffirmed that power, I don't want to say Trump's justice, but a Trump's justice. So power is more important than that. So a rich man's joke is always funny. And the powers always rule. And the conqueror is the one that writes the history books. And this is just an extension of this. This is just another example of the might makes right.
Sure.
If you don't mind, I don't want to put my back to Ibrahim, so I prefer not to use that microphone. I want to honor you. Jack had only a few minutes, so his narrative, of course, left out many salient details, including resolutions by the United Nations that, in the first place, called for the establishment of a Palestinian state that was turned down by the Arab world. Resolution that called for trading land for peace, rejected by the Palestinians and the Arab world. In truth, though, the broader truth is the Palestinians have no real allies. They never have, and that's very sad. They have an antagonist in Israel. The United States has not been an honest broker. The Europeans have been fickle. And if I can make my language a little salty, though not perhaps as salty as Ibrahim's, the Palestinians have regularly been screwed by the Arab world, and there's no sign that that will change. So Jack's question, can there be some international deliberative body that will deliver justice for them? I don't believe so. There could be a decision, there could be another resolution, but what the Palestinians need is an opportunity to build a state, to have their autonomy, to live a decent life, and I don't see that being delivered through the mechanisms that he was asking about. So with that steep hill in front of them, what ought we to be talking about? Well, we need a new generation of leadership on both sides, the Palestinian side and the Israeli side, and I can't say that I'm especially optimistic there. But we're here in Eugene, and so the question is, what do we do from here? So we educate and we engage and we support the NGOs and we visit and we try to use the American political process to more constructive ends. So here in Eugene, for instance, there is a congressman, Peter DeFazio, who believes in some real engagement and wants to use the resources of the United States in a way to help bring this conflict closer to resolution. I don't know that there's ever going to be a complete resolution. But we have the ballot, and we have a budget, and we have opportunities to advocate and to educate here in the United States, and I encourage people to take them. I do hope that it's not too late. The solution, again, that's an overstatement in the word itself, but the path forward has been obvious for a long time. Two states for two people. The United States hasn't done all that it can to foster that solution. It's made some efforts. They've been oftentimes qualified, sometimes half-hearted. This recent step by Trump is in the opposite direction, and we have the opportunity to express ourselves here and to try to influence U.S. policy, which is hugely important in the region if it's used in the right way.
Now we'll break for 5 minutes. I want to thank the speakers temporarily. I'll thank them again at the end, but it was a tremendous presentation. Now we'll ask a break for 5 minutes to formulate questions from each table and then return for the audience questions. Remember, only City Club members can ask questions at the microphone. Thank you, folks. Take five.
This is KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. We're on Facebook and Twitter and online at klcc.org.
Welcome back to the January 19th, 2018 City Club program, Three Views on U.S. Recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's Capital. City Club's a nonprofit organization, and support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including AARP of Oregon, Movasagi Plastic Surgery and Ziba Medical Spa, Evans, Elder, Brown and Siebert Commercial Real Estate, and Johnson & Johnson, Lucas and Middleton, P.C. Special thanks to University of Oregon, our academic extension, and Dot Dotson's Photography, and KVRM, who are in-kind sponsors. Before we go to member questions, please remember to keep your questions short and to the point. We only have 11 minutes left. I'm going to strictly enforce a one-minute time limit for the questions. So the questions can be 1 minute, and after that, I'll ask you to stop. So I'd appreciate your cooperation. So as you can see, we have six people lined up. So quick questions, and if possible, quick answers. First questioner, please.
Thank you. I'm Mariah Learn, co-director of our NECPA Awareness Project, which has hosted over 24 speaker and film events regarding Palestine over the last decade. So, Eib, as a Palestinian, do you endorse the full call by Palestinian civil society for nonviolent resistance to Israeli dispossession and occupation in the form of boycott, divestment, and sanctions as used against South African apartheid, including its three specific goals: to withdraw their military occupation, including East Jerusalem, repeal the 65 laws that discriminate against Palestinian citizens of Israel, and to honor the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homeland?
Well, I do believe in the universal right to every human being who's occupied or oppressed to fight against that oppression, whether it's in a husband-wife scenario or on the national basis. Therefore, I fully support the right of Palestinians to get rid of the occupation in nonviolent means. Yes.
Thank you. Next question, please.
John Attic, City Club member since 2003. Will the Trump decision have the effect of leading to greater violence directed against the United States of America?
Are you addressing that to any particular person, sir?
Pardon?
Are you addressing that to any of the panelists?
Anybody on the group.
Who wishes to answer? Debbie?
Obviously, I'm not a prophet. But I have to say that in the wake of the Trump announcement, I certainly, as an American traveling abroad in the Middle East, I felt it pretty immediately. I mean, yes, I was worried. In terms of entering the Old City, I wouldn't enter the Old City on a Friday. They were considered rage days. And yeah, I was worried about being an American. I was worried about going to places that I've gone to before. I did not go to Ramallah. I did not go to Jericho. These are places within Palestine where Israelis are not permitted, but I've always felt welcome and comfortable. And yes, I would say that Trump has made me as an American worried. And I do believe that there could have been violence, and I wasn't willing to tempt that.
Thank you. Next question, please.
My name is Michael Kerrigan. I'm with Community Alliance of Lane County, which is a member group of the City Club. Question for Ib. Ib, how can we effectively advocate for peace here in Eugene and Springfield? Years back, there was a group called the Middle East Peace Group, which was a broad cross-section of our community that came together to advocate for peace. Should we bring that group back?
I was a co-founder of the Eugene Middle East Peace Group, and as with a lot of the NGOs, the work ends up on the shoulder of a couple of people, and we have busy lives, and somehow it dissipated after quite a few years of existence. So bringing it back, I'm always in favor of dialogue, because I do believe that if we just stay in our silos of believing I am right and the other guy does the same, that the status quo remains and no good things will come out. So I am a big proponent of dialogue based on justice, on openness, on honesty. And if those ingredients are not there, I think it's not worth bringing any group back.
Thank you. Paul?
I'm Paul Thompson, a City Club member. This is addressed to Debbie, but I would welcome comments by any of the panelists. This morning, the press revealed that the Trump administration has selected the Arnona site among the various candidates for the actual location of the embassy, and that they are striking out forthwith to go ahead and to build and upgrade that facility. Could you comment on that selection and what the implications might be?
Sure. I mean, that's the area that we were talking about that the United States has had for a long time. It's a very exclusive area of Jerusalem. I think it'll be interesting to watch because I just walked by it a few weeks ago. I do not see how it's going to have the kind of, I don't know what else to call it, security zone space that the United States now looks for when it builds its embassy. So You know, an embassy is going to take 5 to 10 years for them to build. So how quickly they will, quote unquote, strike ground, I think will be interesting to see.
Robin Fletcher. And my question, our table wondered, we're talking about the area of the embassy as exclusive and with apartment buildings and whatnot. Does President Trump and his family have any financial gain to take place with this?
You know, the whole reason I came today was to find out from you, what was the point of the announcement? I can't say, I don't know. To the best of my knowledge, there's no Trump hotels.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know. I do know that where the U.S. consulate has been in Jerusalem for a long time, it also had not like a no man's land, but these really old buildings kind of surrounding it that didn't really do anything. And there is a very expensive hotel now that's very close to that consulate, just like other consulates have very nice areas around them. I don't know what he's going to do. I can only imagine that it would be to his advantage.
I'm sorry. I'll just
do a little comment on that. I know it was in March of 2016 that Trump, while giving a speech to AIPAC, that he promised to move the embassy to Jerusalem. So there were a bunch of skeptical Jewish leaders, obviously, at AIPAC, and he wanted to reassure them that he does support the State of Israel and he means business. So he means business. Maybe business here in this side, okay?
Thank you. Thank you. Before we thank our speakers, there are a few quick announcements. Thank you to public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club programs Monday at 6:30. And next week, January 26th, please join us for a presentation on what's next for the Oregon Health Plan. More details and information about future programs can be found at City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. And let's thank our speakers, Shaul Cohen, Ibrahim Hamidi, Deb Green, and Jack Dresser. Thank you, folks. That ends today's program.